Today's episode is brought to you by the Consultancy Growth Network. As you'll know, I'm a big believer in learning from people who've achieved the things that you want to. It's why I run this podcast, to share the stories of consulting leaders and how they've got to where they are today. So when I started talking to Mark Jansen and the team at Consultancy Growth Network, it was clear there was an obvious fit between climate consulting and their mission and what they are building with their network. But you're probably asking, what is the Consultancy Growth Network? The Consultancy Growth Network is the leading community of boutique consulting leaders. It brings together seasoned consulting growth experts who successfully scaled their own boutiques, with rapidly growing consulting founders looking to emulate their success. Now, you might be thinking, who are these growth experts? What do they actually know about consulting? And this is one of the most exciting things that personally I find about the network. The team at the Consultancy Growth Network have searched far and wide for some of the best boutique consulting leaders to help their members on their journeys, some of which I have previously interviewed for this podcast, such as Don Morehouse and Augusto Negrillo. But it's not just the insights from these people that you will benefit from. By joining, you get access to their jam-packed calendar of regular in-person and online events, their comprehensive growth hub of resources, and their active Slack community. Through all of these channels, you can learn, solve challenges, and achieve the goals you want for your firm. And now, if that wasn't enough reason to sign up, the Consultancy Growth Network is giving all listeners to this podcast a special sign-up offer. If you join for 12 months, you join for that next year, you will get your 13th month for free, giving you that extra month to continue to build on everything you're learning and continue to benefit from the network. To sign up, just visit consultancygrowthnetwork.com or contact their partnerships director, Luke, at luke@consultancygrowthnetwork.com. And when you're talking about joining, mention Create Engage or Climbing Consulting, and you will get that special sign-up offer. Hi, and welcome to today's episode of Climbing Consulting. As we all know, the last few years have been a crash course in adaptability for consultancies. We have had the global pandemic and the latest challenges in the economy, all of which have meant a very busy time for consultancies and their leaders. And it is for that reason that I wanted to share today's episode, to give you a blueprint, to give you some inspiration, to give you some ideas from one firm who has not only navigated those choppy waters, but used them as a springboard to achieve truly global success. In this one, I speak to Mark Grice, co-founder of Total Negotiation Group, a successful global consultancy that helps its clients to build more sustainable and valuable commercial partnerships. I first heard Mark speak at the Consultancy Growth Network Summit, loved what he said, and knew that he would be fantastic for this show. And I knew you would love to hear his story. And having said yes, we dived straight in. We explored a whole raft in this one, from how a clever pandemic pivot helped them dramatically scale their business, to why they went international so early, and actually how that was the cornerstone of the success that they have seen since. We talk about so much in this episode, and I know you are going to get so much from it. It's jammed with practical advice and insights that you can take away and apply straight away in your consultancy. So, with the intro done, all that's left to say is please enjoy today's episode with Mark Grice. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Zach.
Well, it was great to meet you at the TCGN Summit, and thank you for saying yes to this, because I really enjoyed what you're sharing there, and I'm looking forward to diving in for my listeners. For their benefit and for those who weren't at the summit, it'd be great if you could share a bit of background on who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, Mark Grice, one of the two co-founders of Total Negotiation Group. Prior to setting the business up 14 years ago, it is now, back in dim distant history, I trained as an accountant with PwC. So I was a chartered accountant in London and had a year in the Cayman Islands. So qualified as an accountant, came back to the UK, ended up leaving PwC. I went to work in the city for a South African merchant bank on the financial side. Didn't really enjoy it. I spent a lot of time arguing and dealing with traders about how much money they'd made each day or not, and just thought there's probably a better life than this. Armed with my financial qualification and armed with a desire to go and work for something I could really get behind and be passionate about, I went to go and join Guinness and had a brilliant time at Guinness for a number of years. So I started in there financial audit, international audit department, which was just a great role just to go and see the world, go and see lots of the different units that Guinness PLC, as it was at the time, this is prior to the merger into Diageo, just got transported all around the world, everywhere from Japan to Australia to Peru to the US to Essex to Scotland to Germany to Italy. I mean, it was fantastic as I'm in the mid-20s, seeing the workings of a global consumer goods company and being kind of having quite a lot of pressure at that stage, because you'd go into a market and you'd be asked about how you could improve it. That was our remit, which was pretty hard. Well, I'm a trained accountant who knew lots about insurance companies and defense companies, trying to work with somebody from Heineken on a joint venture as to how they could improve it. That bottling plant was a bit of a challenge at the time. But it did equip me to be very, very good at asking questions, listening intently, and probing those questions behind, which has served me really well ever since. So I did that for a number of years and then loved it. Lifestyle was great, saw the world and learned huge amounts, but wanted to get a bit more onto the front foot. And rather than keep coming up with lots of ideas and improvements as what we could do, and you'd write amazing reports and they'd be submitted to the board, you weren't in control of whether anything happened or not afterwards. So I thought, do you know what? I want to be more in control of my destiny, put myself to the test, not be a backseat driver. And I managed to move into sales, which was a huge change in those days, to go from an audit role into accounts, managing some of the key accounts in the UK. Went into their sales team for the UK, had brilliant boss, two or three brilliant guys I worked with, and learned the whole, how do you manage accounts? Fortunately for me, it involves lots of asking questions. Again, back to my kind of questions piece. When you ask questions of the buyer, what do they really want? And then marry up what you're able to do, you then start to become a really good client manager. So working with lots of different accounts at that stage, had a great time. On a personal side, this was the stage where Guinness was sponsoring the World Cup, Red Bull World Cup. So I had an absolute ball during my first year, doing a lot of hospitality and activation of different promotions. Heaven. I'm working with Guinness, working on rugby, what was not to like. But then within as Guinness and UDB and Burger King and General Mer, kind of all the different bits, Pillsbury, all merged together and become Diageo. Moved on into a bit more of a technological role. So Diageo was making a few kind of tech plays, and I went to work for a business called Translucis. They were putting screens into bars, nightclubs, pubs all around the UK, and beaming in a channel that had advertising, local content, and lots of kind of cool videos. And I was in charge of selling in to the estate. So getting the estate all up and running, having big screens everywhere. Their intention was, how do you reach an 18 to 24-year-old demographic, share with them brand and messages? So we sold advertising, we sold in. So I spent my time selling in the actual screens, then also selling in advertising, which was an eye-opening trip into the world of advertising sales. Again, learned lots, had some brilliant teams of people, worked with some really good people, and just broadened my knowledge of sales, kind of management, leadership. Had a great time, but then had the opportunity to go and work for Disney. So became UK sales and marketing director for Disney. So on the consumer product side in the UK, worked there for a great period of time. Again, understanding a new, different, big kind of global brand with some incredible brands within it itself, leading a really good team of people, managing UK retailers with all these brands, marrying up brands, franchises, and licenses into retailers. Grew the business really, really quickly, brought some innovation into it because we started to sell licenses direct to retail, which was some really good negotiations with some of the big retailers across the UK and then further afield. So really enjoyed that as a role. Then moved on again, went to go and work for a retail marketing agency called Catalina Marketing, big US business. Started off in a sales role, ended up being managing director, and brought out a big data analytics business, but led through to using the data and the insights it got to providing very tailored consumer marketing offers. So you'd receive coupons as you were checking out in somewhere like Sainsbury's. You receive a coupon offering you money off your next purchase. Be very targeted around brands, SKUs. You could get broader messages. Again, spent a lot of time selling into big retailers and really understanding what made them tick. Won a huge deal with Sainsbury's, and that's kind of really laid the foundation for Kathleen in the UK as it's grown and grown ever since. So great business. And then that's kind of the main kind of corporate part of my career. Had the opportunity at that stage to really think about what's the next stages. And we're starting to do a little bit of freelance work when I came out of Catalina, did a few bits of freelance work. And that's when Mark, my current kind of business partner, and I started talking a lot more seriously about some opportunities. So that's kind of led to the birth of TNG. But that's the kind of first big chunk there. And there was a certain inevitability. Mark and I had met at Guinness. We'd always said we'd do something together. We weren't sure what, but we had a lot of similar views, but also kind of quite synergistic kind of skills that would really dovetail in really well within each other. We'd always kind of on the back burner, let's try and do something together and have a bit of fun and kind of what can we go and do together? So that had been on the back burner until that kind of stage.
Well, I think you've filled in a lot of gaps for me, Mark, and you've created a lot of questions that I didn't think I'd ask. Funnily enough, as you'll know with Mark Janssen, who's also been on this show fairly recently, I didn't realize you had shared history in terms of going from accounting to sales. I don't want to spend too long there, but it does fascinate me. How did you get out of audit in a space that is often perceived probably wrongly in a certain way? How did you manage to convince people you could actually sell at a time when all you'd done is audit?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it was a question I was asking myself as I was trying to escape audit. There's probably two or three steps. One, I managed to persuade my boss that I should be auditing the UK sales team. So then I got to know the UK sales team really well and understood what they were doing, which that obviously helps once you start to know everybody there. But then really thinking around what were the links across. And I mentioned it a couple of times at the start, the questioning piece. As an auditor, you have to question and listen brilliantly. If you don't, you're kind of sunk. But I really thought about some of the skills I had. How do you sell? You sell by understanding what your customer wants. How do you find out what your customer wants? You ask them. You can go and research and do that piece as well, but ultimately you need to ask them and corroborate that at some stage, which is what I've been doing. So I really understood the marketplace. I put in a huge amount of research. So I understood the marketplace. I understood what the role would be. I linked across my current skills with some great examples. And then there was a bit about they did take a bit of a risk on me. But yeah, they didn't give me Tesco's to start with by any means. I was starting with a lot smaller accounts and they kept me in that sort of place because they weren't sure how I was going to turn up. But I think it was a really good exercise for all of us. They got a lot from me. The financial background, there's nothing better than being in sales meetings with a financial background that people aren't expecting because that can give you a real advantage as well.
I think a great little detour and some fantastic lessons. And Mark, there's a whole nother podcast someone should have you on around navigating the corporate world. Cause I think that, you know, advice of actually getting in and auditing the sales team to learn them is fantastic. And I suspect we'll weave into the rest of the story as we do talk about Total Negotiation Group. I think just before we go into TNG, and this is what I suspect, you know, this might be like QI where I'm about to walk into something and, you know, it flashes up saying error, but negotiation, the thing you didn't mention is sort of hostages or like police and you know, talking people down off ledges. There's a lot, you know, I've sort of read a few books and things, and there seems to be a lot of negotiation that comes from that world into the corporate world. I'm interested in your take on that. Like, is that something you see as well? Is that good? What's your perspective on that side of negotiation?
It's a great question, and it comes up regularly. I guess, first of all, to be categorical, we don't offer hostage negotiation as any of our services. We're very commercial negotiation focused. I guess I'd probably share a story. I was on a flight to Australia. We'd only been going, I think, 2 years. Going to go and do some work with a client. I was getting on a flight to Manchester and bumped into this guy. Literally, we bumped into each other. Somebody had pushed in front of us and we were both letting them. They were in a much more of a rush to get on the plane because that would get them to their destination quicker than us, who'd be kind of getting onto the plane a minute later. And we were just laughing a little bit about this. Got on really well. And he just asked me what I did. And I explained I was working with a negotiation business. And he shared that he used to be head of hostage negotiation for Manchester Police. And so we got, so therefore, really ripe conversation, which was good. We both flew to Dubai. He was going on to, I think, Zambia. He was head of security for some sugar plantations. So we had a long conversation on the way to Dubai, and we were talking about the similarities and differences. And I think I'd summarize it with, at the end, he asked me, because he'd been asked a lot by some of his commercial leaders, if he could run some negotiation training for his team, for their commercial teams, their sales teams. And he kept saying no, because his view was hostage negotiation, trying to get a knife off somebody who's on a tower block, who's threatening to kind of hurt somebody. It's very, very different than trying to persuade the buyer at co-op that they want to buy some more sugar. There's a lot of different skills. It's very, very high stakes in terms of the hostage. It's around people. It is literally life and death. At the end of the day, corporate negotiations, you're dealing with a buyer who the business is still going to exist, whatever the buyer does. The buyer is making a decision based on for a corporate rather than for themselves. Whereas in a hostage, it's around that particular person and it is that life and death piece. So we've always seen a huge, big difference between commercial negotiation is around, there's an approach, there's experience, there's capability, there's knowing how the marketplace is working, as being very, very removed from kind of hostage negotiation, which is incredibly difficult. And the pressure that's put upon it. I mean, you see the films, you see kind of some of the behind the scenes. It's incredibly tough. But I think as part of what we set the business up, one of our values has always been to be really practical and be realistic. I've never really seen the difference between if somebody's trying to stop somebody killing people, it's hostages at a bank, and having a discussion around how the increased price of cocoa is going to affect the price of a piece of confectionery or piece of coffee, a jar of coffee on the shelves. I think it's quite a tenuous link. And I know that would be controversial because a lot of big corporates love bringing in hostage negotiators at the senior level to try out their kind of senior guys. But I think you're going to get better results by really focusing on the commercial side of it.
I love it. Well, and thank you. As I say, you've definitely opened my eyes because, yes, I was under the view that it was all the same. And, you know, if I can negotiate a hostage down from a ledge or a knife away from someone, then I can negotiate that 50p off. And I think you've touched on a point in there that probably comes out in your story as we talk further. Actually, the complexity of organizations is what shifts that. You know, I could learn some tactics to negotiate with you, but actually the corporate that sits behind you, the decision-making is so much more complex than just, you know, Nick and Mark in this room. I think that gives us a good handle on the starting point. And you know, to your point, that sort of plane ride 2 years in, I almost want to jump a bit, Mark, because I think something that struck me when we were speaking ahead of this was, you know, you mentioned that the business has been going fairly steadily for, you know, I think just over a decade. And actually it's really scaled very quickly since then. And I'd love you to take us on that journey. What was it that led to that? I'm sure you've thought back to it. What was that inflection point?
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of things happened at the same time. And it's, I guess it's pretty common and it's almost a default reason for lots of things. A lot of the change happened around the whole lockdown COVID piece. We had to really reconsider our business. At that stage, we were a good sized, really well-respected training and consulting business that was doing pretty much all our training face-to-face. Of course, as soon as you get into the lockdown phase, we lost practically all our business, just when we can't do stuff face-to-face, nobody can travel. So we really pivoted the business to go very online, at least in that short-term period, to cater to the ongoing need. Negotiations are still happening. People are still selling into customers. People are still trying to think about how they can create value with their customers, but they just couldn't do training face-to-face. So we focused the offer down and took it online. And we were really fortunate. We've always, in our whole offer, we've really thought about the learner experience. We are trying to change behavior. And we've always started from the perspective of what's the behavior we're trying to change in a sustainable way? Working back, how do we make their experience memorable? How do we make their experience relevant to them so that if their learning style is very auditory or visual, let's make sure that their learning experience corresponds to that, because we will sustainably shift them. We're not trying to put on a show or anything. We are trying to make sure that what they learn in an applicable, relevant way. So as we moved online, because we've always been thinking about the different elements of that learning behavior, we were able to move online much more easily. We've always done it on a long-term basis. We don't just go and run a 2-3 day workshop and that's it, magic's happened, you're now going to be brilliant. we've always had long-term relationships with our clients and the people that we are kind of learning and developing for, training and developing for them. Because of that, we were able to really think about what the offer is going forward. And we were able to move it online really well. And finally, because we're developing people in a very collaborative way, we have a very collaborative approach. We work closely and partner with people. We also want them to create value in a collaborative way. We come from the much more collaborative side of the negotiation part that's driven the business to start with. We've always been, because we're more collaborative, it's easier to then collaborate when you're online rather than to try and have an effect on people or create issues or create chasms or create concern or worry. So taking all that online, we really hit a kind of a vein of interest that kind of went really quickly. Clients latched onto this and then took it globally really quickly. We created some brilliant global relationships from there that meant that over time, clients grew our negotiation relationship, but also took us into other areas that meant we were able to offer them a full commercial support partnership. So that was the big piece around the online piece helped dramatically because we were able to move. But then also we diversified our offer. We'd done things outside negotiation already, but by pulling selling together with negotiation, clients were clamoring for that. We were able to deliver it in a brilliant, high-quality way. We then were able to move into other areas like revenue management and category management and planning because our clients were telling us they weren't getting the right solutions. So as we did more of that, we became a complete commercial partner. The relationships grew. And their results really, really started to speak for themselves. So we were getting this feedback around, you're creating superb value for us and our clients. What else can we do? So that was kind of all at that time that it flowed really well. The other probably bit was we took a view that we would focus more. And my time, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, I think, my time became purely focused on selling and managing clients. Previously, Mark and myself and the team, we'd all done bits of lots of things as you do in a lot of consultancies. You sell, you deliver, you manage the business. We took a big decision that I would just go into selling and managing all our clients. And that really helped as well. That focus, and I talk a lot about focus, but I've been able to focus on that really big task. We saw a really nice uptick in that as well. So it was being able to move online, the quality of the offer that we were able to bring, my focus area, and I have diversity, both wider and then going upstream to be able to influence more of what our clients wanting us to help them implement.
Oh, no, I'm a big fan of frameworks and structures, and I love how you just put that into a very nice framework and structure for us to explore. Because I think with hindsight, I think it's very easy for me listening and our listeners to say, well, that makes perfect sense. I imagine in the depths of 2019, 2020, when your physical business has disappeared, you're building a virtual business, you're looking at these different things your clients are asking you to do. I'd love to understand a bit more around the decision-making steps that led to those elements. Because to throw out a few to start the conversation, going upstream, downstream, et cetera, makes a lot of sense, but also comes with a lot of overhead and therefore risk. You know, if one client asks for category management, you mentioned, and you've got to spend forever building the proposition, how you decided that was right. And then I guess also the other one that jumped out, that focus, you know, what was it that made you say we're focusing now? Because I guess that also is, while COVID was the catalyst, you could have focused 5 years prior to COVID, or you could have not focused during COVID. Kind of, I say I pull out two, but I'm interested kind of how you made those decisions during that time that set up the success.
No, I mean, it's a good area to go and explore. The diversity, particularly going upstream, probably came afterwards. So that if we're sequencing them, I think we went through a brief period of like going, yikes, this is our physical business is moved away. We've been doing a lot of growth around the world. How are we now going to manage this? The team was brilliant. I mean, all the members of the team, but I remember working really closely, particularly with Vic and my team. How do we get this online and tell people what we're going to do differently? Because it was a real matter of urgency, we got very clinical and clear on what we were going to do. We're going to do this, not this. We'll do this, not this. We moved it. We got the communication out. And that meant we crystallized what we were doing in a really in a really kind of simple way to support what our clients needed exactly then. So that kind of brought some of the focus. And then over time, as the challenges evolved within our clients, so initially they had lots of people at home who needed developing, who needed to be able to work with their buyers and their customers in a different way. Over time, the subsequent years, that was when the challenges they were facing moved from availability through to kind of 2 years hence was all around price increases and raw material costs. And at the same time, as a business, we could see the growing pull on us to go round. We wanted to still be brilliant in how we're implementing. We were just seeing some of the projects that we were receiving. We were like, if we could have gone involved earlier, we could have navigated this to a better implementation route. So how do we get more involved upstream? So it was, how do we think about bringing that specialism in-house? How do we do that, as you say, without incurring huge cost, massive kind of distraction within the business? So we ring-fenced what we were doing right in the middle, kept that really clear. And then we were really fortunate. We found a brilliant head of solutions came in. Bernard came in, had some amazing contacts, amazing kind of thinking that he was able to then progress with us. So we slowly built out the rest of it. And we'd do it in the way of, we'd have a really good direction that we wanted to go in. And then we'd work with clients or ahead of some of the engagements to then progress that in a stage that we would get it to something that we were really proud that it would be good enough. Because the danger as you expand and widen, diversify the offer is there any degradation in quality? And that's been something we've been passionate about making sure that we won't. Because we are so well renowned for negotiation and selling and implementation, we don't want to kind of have anything going to affect that reputation. So hopefully that makes sense in terms of the sequencing that we did that.
It does, Mark. And I think that that last point is quite interesting, actually, around that, how you maintained that quality. Because again, one of those common challenges consultancies can have is as they diversify their kind of core offering, just gets less focus, and less focus can sometimes mean less quality or, you know, standard slips. Kind of, how did you and the team, you know, keep that plate spinning, the negotiation plate spinning, while doing all the other bits?
So we split the business into practice areas. We had a negotiation practice area headed up by Ralph, one of the team, who's been with us for a long time. He's absolutely passionate on quality. He's known throughout our whole organization. He's known throughout all our clients for his absolutely intense focus and incredibly high standards of materials, of content, and how we deliver them with our clients. He was able to own that piece so that we've got that piece ring-fenced and safe as we're then looking to what else we're going to do with some of the demands that we're seeing from clients.
Sounds like a good person to have on the team. And I guess to that practice piece, because we touched on the kind of delineation of roles. And this might be particular to you and Mark, or maybe Brooke. Like, how did you decide that you were going to split then? Because again, that you'd been going very comfortably for, you know, over a decade with everyone doing a bit of everything.
Yep.
How did you decide, right, we're going to make this shift? And how did you decide the split you went for? Because given your backstory, sales makes sense. But I suspect there was lots of things you could have done in the business. So how did that come about?
There's lots of those with hindsight we'd have done sooner, that's for sure. Because as with most people, because I've been honest, it's never a perfect ride. You learn things, you go, we'd have done that 5 years ago, would it have been different? I think it's sometimes time and a place. You wouldn't make the decisions you would without some of the things you experience. The focus on me kind of going much more into sales was we'd always try to delineate to make it easier for people to understand when they go to Mark or myself. We'd kind of got ourselves to a stage where I was probably a bit more outward facing, managing clients, being the public face, and Mark, who's got a real kind of strength around operationalizing things, improvement, some of those systems and processes to make sure that the business really hums, and he asked brilliant questions around that. So we naturally moved into that, and we're trying to explain to people with almost like an internal and an external one. So we've gone down that route to try and make it easy for people and to do that focus, which worked well for that particular period. And then as the business continues to evolve and got larger, we've then kind of subsequently evolved that style again and again.
And just because you teed me up for it, Mark, I, Are there any other things you mentioned sort of that with hindsight that stand out, particularly of that kind of accelerated growth period over the last sort of 4 or so years? Yeah, anything that you've done that you think, if only we'd done this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that think you think have really helped with that growth?
I think it's probably not a unique comment, but I think with hindsight, would we be bolder? Yeah, because you know how things play out and you go, well, if you'd have been bolder sooner, would it have played out better? And it's something I read about, I hear about a lot in podcasts, and I hear about, we could have got probably more focused sooner on what we're doing. We could have taken more risks. But it's always hard as you are growing a business like a consultancy, going, you take risks. It's getting the right balance between taking too many that you put the kind of fabric of the business at risk versus it's the right thing to go and do. Mark and I have a shared appetite of, we're happy to take the right calculated risks, and we're probably at the more happier to take risks than some. But should we have taken a bit more and been bolder sooner? Yeah, in retrospect, I wouldn't change a lot what we've done. I think, and we'll go on to talk about it, because I know having an overseas business in kind of year one, year two is unusual, but that was a very conscious decision we walked into that then benefited us. It played out some negatives as well, because we've had a kind of, it's sometimes harder to do, but it was absolutely the right thing to do. It would be very much be bold, know how good you are. I mean, we've known all the way through that our products and our services are really good. We came into the marketplace knowing who our competition would be. We set ourselves the benchmark of being at least that good, and we've delivered on that all the way through. If you know you're very good when you benchmark yourselves, then it's a case of, right, how do you really push this? If you can back yourself, then take the risks, be bold, and really go for it. Be really clear on what you're trying to go for. There's this kind of sometimes blind go for it kind of hesitation. But I think if you can be really clear on what you're trying to go for, then absolutely go for it.
No, I think some great pieces in hindsight. And it might be the flip side of that, but I know when we were speaking ahead of this, you mentioned you'd done a lot of things differently in building the business. And actually, in a similar vein, kind of looking back, what are some of those things that you feel you've done differently that have really accelerated you? And similarly, if there's anything that actually, with hindsight, you probably would have done it the orthodox way. I'd just be fascinated. And yeah, those little learnings that others could get as well.
Yeah, we went overseas early. We had an opportunity. Mark and I looked at each other and went, do we want to take the opportunity that we are seeing in Australia, which is, yeah. We had a contact some years ago who'd phoned us up going, do you want to work in Australia? And we were unsure. We were in year two. It absolutely was not in any of the phases 1, 2, 3, or 4 of our planned growth. As we all know, plans go out the window as soon as you finish them. Brilliant opportunity. We seized it, and which has enabled us to probably be more globally focused right from the start. It's meant we've worked in, I think, up to 90 countries now. Taking that opportunity meant we've gone more globally. It's meant we've able to service clients on a geographical level and really punch at least our weight, if not above our weight, in how we're able to work with our clients for a kind of consultancy our size. So that bit around take the opportunities and not always be scared, because a lot of time I get told, yeah, you should. I think when we were at the TCGN summit, it was, yeah, you should grow to a size and then think about growing overseas. None of these rules are hard and fast, as we know. And that's not to say that isn't really good guidance, but there's always differences, aren't there? And you've got to really look at yourself and think, is this right for us or not? And then own the decision. We knew the decisions we'd made. We've had a couple of blips in Australia. The person who's now running our business there is not the one who was running it 10 years ago, but we've learned a lot. We've found a really great guy who's with a really good team around him, who's running that really well at the moment. So owning the decisions, being comfortable with them, and then whatever happens, you know you made the decision for the right reasons, but be clear on what you think is going to be successful or not from it, and then that helps you course correct as you need to go, as you go down the line, and then you keep reviewing, is this working or not, and being honest with yourself.
I think some great advice, and why don't we touch on the global piece, because I'm sure people would be frustrated with me if I missed that, having had such a good tee up from you there, Mark. And tell me more about particularly the decision-making, because like you say, someone calls up and you know, offers you some work and a contract. That's always brilliant when you're early on in your journey. When it's halfway across the world, and this was pre-COVID when
bums were on seats, that changes the thing. You decided it was the right decision. So how did you and Mark decide it was right? And what were those criteria to say, yeah, this is going to be the thing that moves us forwards?
And there was a range of different decisions in that. A, being Australia, it's not the worst country to go and work in. It was great fun. Part of it was the two of us would go out there together a lot of the time. So there was an element to being able to enjoy it. And one of the things all the way through is we've tried to really enjoy what we do. One of the reasons we wanted to work together was to just have some fun time together. Work can be, you work for a long time, you work hard. If you can bring some level of enjoyment with the people you work with and enjoy it yourselves. So Australia was a good place to go work. We've had some brilliant times over there. The opportunity was great. We could also see the synergy. So the marketplace, UK and Australia, the retail marketplaces have an element of similarities. So the consulting environments. So we thought we're doing okay in the UK. If we can transfer it over there. We knew some good people there. And we thought if we keep going, we could see a kind of runway over at least a year or two that meant let's invest the time. Let's see if we can grow a business whilst we're there, as well as manage the challenges that would come when the two of us are all the way around the other side of the world, 2, 3, 4 times a year. We'd go for 2 weeks at a time. The money was good, but it did mean we were either 9 or 11 hours disjointed from the UK and the heart of our business on a number of occasions during the year. We'd managed some of the challenges around. We then started to win a lot of work over there. We had to try and resource it. I think 1 year I had 7 or 8 trips to Australia in a year, which was from Emirates' point of view, they loved me. From my kind of year-round keeping up my desire to enjoy traveling, that was good. My wife and my family weren't enjoying it at all. But it's kind of one of the things you do right at the start. You throw yourself into things. If you're going to do it properly, you do it full on, you go hard at it. So we seized that opportunity. And from there, it paid off because some of the clients we worked with, as usual, we did an amazing job. The delegates and the people we worked with were fortunate. Australians can be quite a globe-trotting group of people. They then spread out across the world. And because they'd loved what we'd done for them, over the subsequent years, they've gone to different geographies and pulled us in and going, look, what you did there, can you go and do it over here? And because everything we do is always customized and tailored, they'd know that we could go into a different market, adapt what we've learned, and then do a really kind of effective job in the next market. So really, the kind of global piece was make a big category, give it your absolute all, and go really hard at it, and then hopefully you'll then reap the benefits. There's no point sticking your toe in. If you stick your toe in, it'll get bitten off. Go in hard, be clear on what you are going to commit to and not. Try and put the support around it you need, but then follow up. There's no point going there and going, that was nice. We both worked really hard on making sure that all the people we got to know, the contacts, the positive feel about us, we followed up and followed up and followed up. And that's then, it continues to benefit us to this day. People that we met many years ago are still kind of calling us, going, can I get some help? Or can you come and help me or the team? And we've been really fortunate that people still want us to come and do that. It's fortunate, but also a benefit of us working really hard to do an amazing job out there.
Yeah, no, and I think a great story for anyone thinking of sort of launching abroad, because to your point at the summit, obviously there were some rules of thumb and sort of scale points. And I do see, you know, in the network and outside, I see a lot of firms where they build a solid base in country and then have sort of little, you know, outposts. And I think your point around that kind of don't dip your toe in, you've kind of got to jump in the water. How did you set the business up for success, particularly at that early stage? Because, you know, when you're 1 million, 2 million revenue, there's not tons of you in the business, but you obviously have to build an operating model that works in, you know, well, you have to be global because you're as far away from each other as you could possibly be in the UK and Australia. What steps did you take to build that almost global operating model from day one?
We got a really great central office team to make sure that they would always be grounded, so that all the administration, the operations, the finance piece was done centrally through some superb people who were always there for us. But then it sounds a bit kind of just a bit simple. Then you just work really hard to make it happen. We would be delivering kind of programs for clients and then finishing those. And then because the UK had been waking up, you'd then work through the evening to catch them on the business. and then you'd wake up early in the morning dealing with stuff you hadn't dealt with. You end up working phenomenally hard, but you can see how it's going to benefit you. So it's kind of that, have the really key central support in place back to underpin it all. But then also you just have to work hard. And I wish there was better insights into the magic formula, but there's part of it. Everyone goes, wow, it's brilliant. You're in Sydney, you're having a ball. It's like, well, yeah, I'm kind of working from here to here. Then I'm with a client, then I'm working here and you're working UK and Australia times. And yeah, better to do when you're younger, I can tell you.
Well, you've answered, my next question was going to be, how do you manage that kind of business development, both sides of the pond, or not pond, sorry, both sides of the world? And I think like your answer, if I'm inferring correctly, is, well, you just work 2 days in a day and you speak to people in their time zone. You just, as you said, you work hard and the results come with it.
And it's exactly right. Because for me, ever since we started, Mark and I have talked about, there's three elements to your business. You've got to sell what you do. Then you need to deliver it absolutely brilliantly. And then you need to manage the business, and you need to do all three of those all the time. Because if you stop selling, you create gaps in your pipeline. If you don't deliver brilliantly, people are not going to phone you up again. Your reputation falls. And if you don't manage the business, doing your accounts and keeping in touch with people, following up with your clients and making sure the tax is all done and everything, then your business doesn't happen. So the biz dev side, it would be lots and lots of time on the phone, being really mindful of who you're speaking to. So always be as local as you can. We're really conscious that if we're speaking to somebody in North America, we'll be as North American as we can. We've then spent a lot of time and effort putting people in place. We now have locals in every market. We talk about speaking the right language. We don't just mean being able to speak Spanish in Spain or being able to speak Latin American Portuguese in Brazil. We know the market. And it's really important to be able to really put yourself in their shoes and understand their challenges. But just, yeah, maximize all the hours you can. The number of calls we've done in the back of taxis, or you finish a program, you go out, you go to another office, you go to another office, you go meet people. But it's part of what you're going, you put in the shift. And it's, as you put in the shift, people respect it. But it also, you generally get the right rewards from it.
No, I think some great advice. And there's an interesting piece, again, just thinking of kind of common or orthodox advice versus sort of things you've done. Obviously, one of the benefits of staying in market is you build a brand for yourself, if you like. So if you were in the UK and you work with loads of UK businesses, people know you. You've obviously taken the view that you'll get to know people and they'll be in their local market. I guess, how have you built that? And particularly in those earlier days, how did you build that reputation? Was it just staying close to those key buyers and knowing who they were? Was there something else you did in that? Because I think that in itself is a fascinating piece of how you were able to grow so quickly across those different markets.
It's there's a big element of marketing to it. Marketing is a broad umbrella. It's once you start doing marketing, you have to keep doing it to keep fueling it. So we've always tried to do at least an acceptable level of marketing to make sure that people are aware of us. We're fortunate. The type of business we do, we don't just do big consulting projects where we create lots of value through different initiatives. We've trained and developed a lot of individuals, thousands and thousands of people over the years. We stay in touch with them because they go on. We're fortunate we work with some brilliant organizations. So a lot of the people we've been exposed to, they go on and into different places. By staying really close to them and maintaining those contacts, they're then able to take us with them, as I said before. That's almost marketing in itself and being able to keep spreading ourselves. And then as we've put in place the right coverage across the world and having the right local people, they're then able to latch onto that. So we're trying to do it from a global level. We're trying to do it from a local level, and then also do the right sort of events to make sure that people see how relevant we are, because we pride ourselves on being able to react quickly. We're not a traditional training or consultancy company. We adapt really quickly. We learn, we adapt, we evolve. We keep making sure what we do is really relevant to our clients and to the people who work within our organizations so that they can get the right support straight away. So there's a kind of mixture of a few different bits within there.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And to your point of the trainees, I think often it's an area that seems obvious, but so many training businesses forget that they've got, armies of marketers who've been through their courses if you just keep in touch with them and leave a good impression. And there's an interesting, I think you may have answered it earlier, but I'll ask it in case it sparks anything, Mark, is, you know, obviously you've grown sort of very successfully, and we will come on to the fact you doubled in I think a year fairly recently. Again, consulting orthodoxy says you need to have big programs. You know, just doing a training offering for a discrete, you know, product, in this case, let's say negotiations, only going to get you so far. You've obviously bucked that trend. And to your point earlier, it might have been that COVID shift of actually going sort of up and downstream was the unlocker for you. But I'd love to understand your approach to scaling the business sort of in the negotiation space. Because again, when I meet people who are running training businesses, there's lots of them exist at like 5 people big, 10 people big. Very few manage to scale as you have. Kind of how have you been able to do that? I mean, I'd say beyond, but maybe it's the answer is without just burning lots and lots of shoe leather. What has been your approach to scaling that offering?
It's not just constraining ourselves to training. You won't really see the word training on our website or anything we do, because we try and develop the capability of both the organizations and then the individuals within there. So as we're training people, because we only work in-house, so one of our big kind of big points of difference is we only work in-house. So we're working with a team from my clients. We get under all sorts of confidentiality, but we work on their real commercial issues. So as you're hearing all their real commercial issues, as you're training, as we are developing them, then you're mindful of these issues and you go, do you know what? We can also help you with that and that. Because training an individual is different than developing a team who has a specific commercial challenge that we know we can not just hit there, develop them to be able to meet the challenge once. If we can really develop the muscle of the overall organization by helping them change how they go to market or change their pricing strategy or change what their approach is across the different channels. So whether kind of as they evolve to omni-channel approach, how do we change all of that rather than just kind of developing an individual? As soon as you access that, there's some huge opportunities there that's enabled us to become this amazing partner to organizations who turn to us going, we know you're training, developing, training, helping the team become better themselves, but we can see how you may be able to help us shift over here as well. And that's been a big unlocker for us, because we know their issues, we know their business, we know the marketplace, we've got the skills. We're a kind of really good partner at that stage for them to go, okay, let's go and put you onto this. Rather than go and kind of engage one of the big global consultancies who do an amazing job of kind of being kind of front of mind for a lot of big global corporates, if we can find our way in through, we execute brilliantly, we know all your teams, we know your issues inside out, we become a really good option that's often more accessible for companies to work with to get the exact right results. Because it's the implementation piece of consultancy that's often the hardest, and it's something we A, pride ourselves on, and B, we're really, really well renowned for now, and that makes a huge difference.
I love that, Mark, and the obvious piece in there of actually listening. You mentioned earlier, you know, about how you moved from audit into sales, of that listening skill, and actually, yes, if you're in a room teaching people to negotiate on their real deals, you're learning that, and you are getting everything you need to have that follow-on conversation and see how you can support them, that we probably all do get, we just don't always pay attention to. And is a great piece of advice for anyone running a training, or to your point, you're not purely training, but for anyone running a training business, actually listening to what you get given could give you all of the unlocks for that future growth as well.
It's an undervalued skill, listening, and the hackneyed phrases, there's a reason you've got 2 ears and 1 mouth. But yeah, people listen more and then really think about what they're hearing and take the time. There's a lot of answers out there that people don't often recognize.
No, completely agree with you. I'm going to try and segue, and it's cliche, but I'm going to do some more listening, Mark, because I think we've talked a lot about, you know, the growth in general and COVID, but I think to bring us up to date, that point of inflection, I think this is what you touched on at the TCGN summit, that kind of doubling of revenue in a year, and I'll let you sort of place us, but my understanding is that was kind of this post-COVID era where, you know, a lot of businesses did well in COVID, but actually the recent times, a lot of the market has found challenging, particularly the last 12 months, a lot of consultancies have really struggled. And so I'd love to understand, what was it that, for yourselves, you know, it sounds like that's been a great period, what was the shift there? And was it just more of the same? Or was there something specific that you and the team did to really help that kind of hyper growth?
Mark and I talked a little bit around, it had been coming for a while. We put an awful lot of work in. We created some amazing relationships. We had a great offer, and we were just being patient. We knew it would come. We were doing all the right things. And then COVID hit. We did a reasonably good job through COVID. But off the back of that, a lot of what we'd done earlier in preparation around getting the business ready, getting the offer ready, getting the people right. I mean, we've probably not talked enough about people. I mean, the people we have at our organization are unbelievable. I'm so proud. It's the thing I'm most proud of is the people that we have within our organization. They are of incredible quality. So we've got these amazing people who can just deliver incredible work. We've got the relationships. We've got the offer. If we can then position ourselves in the right place, it should happen. And it did start to happen. And that was where we were, the relationships we've been building over a while started to really flourish. I think that was where that made a big difference. We were, it's some of that focus, me focusing on sales and being able to go, right, these clients that's really focused there and these ones and here and start to join some of the dots that you've got this issue, we can do this. By starting to link those together was when it started to really escalate quickly, which led to its own challenges. And the challenges around that growth as the things are coming together to then grow to meet the challenge is probably the hardest thing we've had, because we brought in new structure, we brought in new people, we brought in new ways of doing things at the same time as trying to harness a lot of growth. My biggest takeaway from that period was never underestimate the challenge of growth and change. We changed a lot as we brought in a lot of new people, trying to induct people, get them really clear on what our priorities, our focus, our offer, our ways of working, our values, our vision. That's really, really hard, because you can forecast and you can plan, but then things change straight away. We think we've got the right resource, and then you're having to try and change and adapt a little bit, and then you're still growing quickly. It's very, very easy to underestimate that challenge of change. And that was hard. That was really hard. And that was probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. Really difficult. Year and a half ago.
Well, I think, why don't we stay there for a minute? Because to your point, Mark, that scaling piece, and we run services businesses, everyone who listening to this runs a service business, that the number one challenge with people businesses is people. And you can hire the best negotiation trainers in the world, but you've got to teach them your methodology, your approach, et cetera. How did you, or what structures did you find work to kind of get everyone up to speed at the speed they needed to be to meet the growth you were having? Because if you're growing 100% in a year, whatever metric you're using to judge that, that's a lot. That's a lot of pace. How did you do that so the wheels didn't fall off, if you like? Because we've all heard those stories, you know, bringing 50 people who know nothing about the business goes wrong. How did you avoid that?
Well, we didn't fully avoid it. Let's just be really clear. We had some real challenges in that time, but we really tried to be clear on how we inducted people. We brought in more and more structure and process so that people were really clear on what they were doing and why and how and what the tools were. We invested a lot of time and effort in making sure we were systemizing as many of our internal processes and internal ways of working as we could. We thought we got a lot of it in a good place. And it's only when you really stress test and push it that you start to think, yeah, possibly could have done this even better. And we can be hard on ourselves and going, I wish we'd done more of this or more of this. That's kind of one of our big learnings, is how do you make sure you keep improving when you see things on the move, that you improve it for the next time? Because we tried to do what we thought was right. We tried to communicate more and more. We tried to get teams together more and more. We had lots of kind of access to information and communication. So we did a lot of that, but we could have done more. And we could have learned more, we can keep adapting. And I think that was something that you need to almost be just restless around that. You're always kind of like, how do you do this even better? Because change and getting people firing 100%, if you can get all your people firing 100%, that's utopia. But it's so hard to do, because the intentions are all really solid and great all the way around, but trying to then link them together and make sure you all get into the right place at the right time with the right knowledge at the right. It's hard. So I don't know if that, I think that helps.
It does. And I appreciate the honesty. And I'd love to know, you mentioned things started breaking. what were those one, two, or three things that broke first for anyone who's about to go on this journey or is seeing quick growth? What were those things that, yeah, you found just broke first and you needed to fix?
Yeah, I mean, all of those stuff totally broke. I think nothing broke. What I would say was we made things a lot harder for ourselves than we could have done. I think our ability to forecast and be really honest around your forecasting. I speak as a kind of dyed-in-the-wool ex-accountant, but a dyed-in-the-wool salesperson. Now, I always want to be really optimistic, but it's being really honest around the quality of what you're forecasting and building in the right contingencies and plans to make sure that that comes in. Because as we all know, the top line drives everything else. And if the top line's in good health, then most things are going to be good. As you grow, if you can rely on those forecasts and those plans, then that's a tremendous amount of confidence. That means everything else can work better. But I'd say that the honesty of forecasting and really being honest to yourself around, is this happening when you call it, and making the kind of calls around, no, that's not going to happen, and calling it early enough. That's a big one, because it's so, has such an important impact on the rest of it. So that's something we've learned a lot, is how do we have very honest kind of performance forecast conversations? And that's something that's really sat with me. And you just have to keep learning around that, because you try and plan, you forecast, you put resources and everything, but it's predicated on that top line, isn't it?
It is. Well, I think, like you say, such a, I guess, a challenging skill to master. And I imagine one where you have a lot of internal turmoil as an accountant and salesperson, Mark. You know, one side of you is probably telling you it's never going to come in, and the other side's going to say, absolutely, it is. And I guess to that point around sort of optimism versus pessimism, you made a point in terms of this growth phase you knew was going to come based on what you were doing. And I'd love to know, what gave you that confidence to that exact point? You know, it's very easy to delude or confuse ourselves and say, oh, it's going to come, it's going to come, it's going to come, when it's not. Obviously, in your case, you were right about it. So what gave you the indicators that you were doing the right thing and success would follow?
For us, it was probably splitting out the inputs and the outputs. The outputs can be going well, but if you really honest with yourself, you know you can get some benefits or outputs that are not always the direct result of what you're doing. You can have some upsides and some wins, and you're going, wow, that's great. But you've got to then trace those back to, is that as a result of what I was actively doing or not? So that's the output side. When you isolate the inputs, because there's a lot of things in the world you can't influence, but if all your inputs and what you're doing is right, you've got the right offer, if you've got the right people, if you've got the right pricing, if you've got all these elements right, and you've been quite objective with yourselves, going, is there anything else we should be doing, or do we think? You're really objective, and you go, do you know what? I think we're doing everything right. There's not a lot else I think we can do. Then you always have to trust the process, and then go, it will come. But you've got to be objective and not kind of live in a rose-tinted world. Go, yeah, it'll be fine. We were really kind of being clear on, have we got the basics right, and have we got the all the elements right that it will come, but it might be a macro factor or there's other little bits that are affecting it, that we're not getting the easy wins or there's other things affecting it. And then it's just a case of trust the system and trust the process, and something will come. And that's what we did. But you've got to be tough on, is there anything else we could be doing, or should we be doing something differently? That's the kind of the probably the nugget for me.
No, I love that. And actually, just because I haven't heard it described as simply as that, how did you define what were the right inputs? Because there's lots of inputs you could measure. How did you define what was it that was driving those outputs? Because again, on the other side of the coin, it's very easy to focus on the outputs and say, oh, we got a great sale, so things are going well, versus are we doing the right things to feed into that? How did you get clarity around that?
I think having an ability to have some patience. Both of us can be really impatient and restless. But you sometimes have to go, do you know what? We've done this, and over time, this will happen. Because particularly in the consulting world, you want stuff to happen tomorrow, and clients often do. You can almost have to go, this is going to actually take some time, and be clear on what those are. So the inputs would be, we knew the client, every single client that was working with us loved what we did. absolutely loved what we did. So that gives you a real reassurance that, right, product, office, service is good. And we can be really challenging ourselves, and we're making sure the client's giving us kind of honest feedback. And then it was like, okay, are we pricing this right? Yeah, I mean, people are buying it, and we think we're pricing it fairly. We're benchmarking across the industry. Are the people that we're using right? We think so. Are we selling this in the right way? Are we getting enough bread on the water? Are we speaking to the right people? Are we marketing? Are we growing awareness? We think so. We can always do more of that. You can always market better and make more people aware of yourself, but we're doing an okay job. So it's those sorts of inputs that we'd go down and kind of score ourselves against and think, are we doing this stuff right? Yes. It wasn't to say we'd then sit back and we're both like, right, we'll be all right in 6 or 12 months' time. We're still doing what we can, but we knew fundamentally what we were doing was correct. And then, yeah, so it's that deep down, the real core bench, the kind of foundations we kind of isolated and kept challenging ourselves on those. And Mark and I spend a lot of time challenging ourselves on the different elements of the business, going, what about this? How do we make this better? Or why is that not working as well? And we've always been able to have those kind of pretty honest conversations with each other.
I like you say, that honesty and that focus. I also, by the way, love the phrase bread on the watermark. I think we're going to have to borrow that for future use. You mentioned a couple of pieces around kind of your relationship with Mark, and you know, you mentioned there around you can have those honest conversations. You did answer my question about how you met sort of way back in your introduction. So I was going to ask about that, but actually I'd love to know about how you two have built that relationship and co-running the business, because I can't remember where it is. It might actually be Joe Omani, who many of my listeners will know, you probably know. He's a professor in consulting, and he did some research about consulting firms that fail. And I might be getting this completely wrong, but I think he found one of the large reasons for consulting failures was partners falling out. And, you know, you two have been working together now for longer than many people get married. And I'd love to know how you have made that work. Like, what is it that has kept you two working so well together for so long?
It's a really good question, and kind of what I reflect on quite a bit. I think getting on well to start with, yeah, can be a plus or a minus. You never know. It's usually a plus, but things can always change, as you say. We've always seen having two of us running the business has been a really, really positive thing. And the more I speak to other people I know who run their own businesses on their own, I just think if you can find somebody you get on well with, the power of two is much more than twice as good as one person, because you even each other out. You can bring different skills. One of you's having a bad day, the chances of both having a bad day are less. And you've got somebody to bounce things off. You've got somebody to really sense check and challenge yourself. And I think that leads into your question around how do we kind of keep getting on really well? And I think we have massive respect for each other's abilities. And it's that respect for each other's skills. How do we make sure that I often think, how do I use Mark's skills and capabilities in the right way? In which parts of the business should we really make sure we use him, and vice versa? And Mark does a really good job of, he'll often say, look, you're like brilliant at selling. How do we make sure you're in more selling conversations? And Mark is very good at the sales piece inside, but he's also very good at the challenge. He will bring the challenge and the honesty to us both. And he's much more honest to me than I am to him, and much more objective, but that's a real kind of something he's always had. And he's very good at putting out scenarios and hypotheses, and I'll build on them. So it's quite good when you have somebody who's happy to go to 60-70%, and then somebody else can take it all the way and add some magic and creativity. We've got some nicely dovetailing styles, but we're aligned 95% of the time. On if we're both to be kind of, what would your answer be to this and what would be your answer to this? We generally aligned, but we come at it from different styles. I'm much more yellow, extrovert, creative, run very, very quickly, throw out loads of ideas. Mark is much more, yeah, but how would that work? And grounds it and operationalizes it, which is, so that works really well. But we've both always set out with the intention of enjoying it. We spend a lot of time trying to enjoy ourselves as well. We've used the business, particularly in the early days of the vehicle, where I talk about when we're in Australia, we're going to places. We'd work hard, but we'd go play hard as well. We've got a lot of same shared interests. So we make sure that we respect each other's skills. We push each other to use our skills in the right way. which, I mean, you know, all of us in any role, if we're doing stuff we enjoy, we're good at, then we'll enjoy doing them and we'll do them well. So if you've got somebody else also making sure you're doing that, then it's usually a good recipe. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, and I love that bit, Mark. We forget that there should be a fun side to all of this in a world governed by numbers and growth. I think that reminder that actually, if you're going to spend your day doing something, you may as well enjoy it is a good piece of advice. The other side, and this might be just to how you two work together, but I know, you know, we spoke ahead of this. You gave an analogy of kind of growth is like going up, you know, sports leagues and kind of rugby leagues and metaphors, analogies. I can only do sport. If we go off piste, I'll have to sort of wave the white flag. But I always think that's an interesting area as well, because, you know, when you start something with someone, you know, take the sports. If you go and play for the local rugby club, you know, you're great. And then it goes up a league and suddenly there's new players and you know, competition's fierce for positions. Almost, how have you and Mark, I guess, kept each other at that level you need to as you grow? Because I imagine, again, I don't have a business partner, but I imagine if you do, that's the other challenge, is one of you might have been great at running a 10-person business, but now, you know, you're the size you are, that's a different league. How have you two kind of kept each other honest in that and kept your skills moving forward with the league you're in?
It's a really good question, because what we keep finding out is, because we've been fortunate and we've worked hard to make sure we've grown for 10, 12, 13 years in a row, we are both running businesses the size that we've never run before because it's growing. So we're both kind of very kind of honest about we don't always know what we're doing. In the same way as for people who have children, it's like a kind of scary thing. You don't know how to kind of parent children and have them, because there's not a lot of great areas to go and learn. As the business grows and you go up into upper leagues, and I like the fact we're in the world of sports analogies, because that's an area we're very comfortable in, and we often call ourselves on not using too many sports analogies. But as you go, you have to kind of keep what you're trying to achieve, you have to keep that really transparent for people and really front and center, because you need different skills and you need different talents and capabilities as you go up the leagues. Because as you say, you might be in lower leagues, you need something to do a job. But as you get much more senior, you need people, different geographies, because you're going internationally. You need to know how to play in different competitions. The rules become more refined and different. The rules of engagement change. So we've always been kind of, we try and be really honest and open. We communicate a lot as a business. We try our best to communicate as openly as we can by setting ourselves up. This is where we're trying to go. And these are some of the steps we're going to need on that journey. We're going to be bringing in different skills. We're going to be developing different talents and different capabilities. As we pull that mix together, the team that we needed 5 years ago is different than the team we need today. We're also mindful it's different than the team we'll need in 2 or 3 years' time. So we've been trying to create a leadership team so it's not just Mark and I. Mark and I were running the business X years ago. We now have a team around us so that there is greater structure, there's greater depth, there's greater capability to go and have these amazing conversations. And as we've brought in the leadership team around us, we've been delighted with the amount of talent there is, the different thinking, the different perspectives. And we're always as open as we can to those different perspectives and to challenge. So one of our longstanding kind of values of the business has been, and should be, both practical and challenging in a really positive way. So we're open to, why are we doing it that way? Shouldn't we try this, or this might work better? Love hearing that, because we don't know everything at all. We try and surround ourselves with people who do, and give them the platform to be able to voice that and to share with us some of their thoughts and different ideas.
No, it makes a lot of sense, Mark. And I guess to try and take the sport probably further than it should go, it's the team was 15, you know, to use the rugby numbers, but now it's a team of 30 on the pitch. And actually it's not just about changing the 15 players. It's about getting a few more players on the pitch as well.
What did you say? I mean, yeah, international rugby is now, everyone talks about it being a real squad game. It's a 23 person game, isn't it? Whereas you play at a low level, if you've got 15, you're delighted. Everyone expects to play the whole game because it's not all about the subs. So you're right. It's as you go up in levels of intensity and some of the challenge, you need to bring in more results.
No, definitely. And definitely, having played in teams where, yeah, the 15, if you hit 15, that was a good week. I know exactly what you mean, Mark. Well, Mark, I think that is a great place to start to bring us towards the end of today. I'm conscious it's kind of Monday afternoon, and I know you'll have things, and by the sounds of it, you'll have another working day in Australia to do after this one in the UK. So I do want to let you get back to your day. Just for me, and these are questions I ask all of my guests, just two final questions. So the first is one about books. I like reading. Number of my listeners do. It may or may not be what you do, and you'll tell me in a minute. But the question is, what is the book or books that you've gifted or read most, and why is that?
So we've always traditionally, for a number of years, for our kind of ongoing clients, we always send out negotiation books at the end of each year. Thank you. It's just been something we've done. We're writing them, send them out, and we've got quite a number of clients who've got a little mini negotiation library. So we've always done that. And it will depend on, we go for collaborative type. That's our style of negotiations. We've always kind of focused in that area. So a lot of negotiation books we've gifted, hundreds and hundreds of books. I think wider than that, the two areas I talk about a lot are probably EQ. Always been a huge, huge fan of EQ. I know it's not a brand new concept by any means, but it's still so incredibly relevant because the way you interpret it and the way you think about how you get on with people and you communicate with people is just as relevant as it always has been. So recommends the EQ, emotional quotient, to a lot of people. And then the second one that's probably been the last few years is a book called, it's a huge weighty tome. It's called Where Cultures Collide.
That is a book. Obviously, our listeners can only hear this, but that is a huge book.
It's massive. It's nearly 600 pages. So it looks good on the bookshelf. But it's all about how you lead across cultures. So it picks out differences between particular cultures. So as we've been, I've always traveled a lot. I mean, I've been to kind of dozens and dozens of different countries around the world. Always been mindful to try and respect the countries you come to, act in a really appropriate way and be as, not anonymous, but you morph into what the style of that country is. So you can be part of it, learn from it. And then as you go, you can become an ambassador for a lot of different countries. This has really helped me think about the differences between cultures. It talks about cultures rather than just countries, which I think is quite an important difference. So yeah, when cultures collide, leading across cultures, how you manage businesses across different countries and try and work with different sets of people. So really interesting book.
Fantastic recommendation. Not one I've had before, Matt, which is always a great place to be. And just because, given your expertise in negotiation and to help our listeners who may have been, you know, off to buy the latest hostage bestseller, I'd just love to know, what is your, you know, if someone listening to this is just wants to pick up one negotiation book, what is yours? I don't want to throw out any ideas just in case they get laughed out of the room. So what is yours?
Books like Getter. I don't know. There's a few of them that are around collaborative. So it's just anything that is helping people jointly have value creation conversations. There's one specific one I'd recommend. There's a raft of them out there. Just make sure it talks positively around how you collaborate with people. You don't want to end up in these kind of aggressive negotiations where nobody wins. We're always very much around. There's always a way. If you ask enough questions and you are creative enough on the variables, you will find a way to create value and create solutions.
Fantastic. Well, I will... If there is a list that you give to people, share it afterwards and we can put it in the show notes. If there's,
yeah, we have a reading list we give out.
That'd be brilliant, Mark, because I think I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you're about to say Getting to Yes, which is a book I've read and I did enjoy. But I say, you might tell me it's a terrible book.
No, it's really good. I mean, Yuri's one of those people who's very, very kind of well respected on this, and a lot of the theory around negotiation comes from a lot of that program, Harvard Program on Negotiation. So yeah, it's one of the ones we definitely have sent out in the past, and yeah, absolutely in that arena.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad I've read a good book on it, as well as How to Take Hostages Down. No, sorry, we don't want our hostages taken down. How do we take hostage takers down? But yes, if you have a list, that'd be amazing. We can then put that in the show notes. And then the final question, and this is again one that I ask all my guests, could be recap of things you've talked about, or it could be, you know, just a roundup and a focus for these people. But you have three people in front of you, and you're going to give advice to each of them. One is just starting their career in consulting, so, you know, like you were way back as a PwC auditor. One is, I use manager level because it makes sense across bigger consultancies, but that kind of middle of the grades. And then one is just approaching partner, or, you know, like you did, looking to go out on their own. Yeah, that kind of senior decision like point. And as I say, the question is, what one piece of advice would you give to each of them?
Now, I think three really good differentiators there. For somebody just starting their career, get as much hands-on, real-life, actual experience as possible. That's what's going to equip you going forward. Theory's really good. Actual experience is just brilliant. It will stand you in great stead. Say yes to everything. Do as much as you can. Don't be frightened. Just go and get actual hands-on experience. Second one, manager level. It's all about the people. That stage, it's people, people, people. Focus on the people, including yourself. Know people's strengths, know people's weaknesses, and help everybody develop. What are the clear development plans for the people around you, including yourself? So it's very much people focused for me, a manager. And then somebody approaching partner level, be clear on what you want to get out of your life at that stage. Do you want to keep learning? Do you want to keep growing? Is it around your life balance? Is it around financial security? Is it around adding strings to your bow? So at that stage, you're kind of getting to that partner level, what you really want to get out of it, so you can set yourself even clearer goals for what you want from the next stage. Because that will help you determine, do you want to be working on your own, in a group, in a big global place? Do you want to focus on a particular, depends on what you want to get out of it.
I think some great advice there, Mark, and a really nice way to round us off. This has been brilliant. I obviously enjoyed hearing you speak at the summit, and it's been great to dive into more detail here together. The very last one is obviously, if anyone listening wants to find out more about yourself, about Total Negotiation Group, where would you point them to? Where can they find out more?
Website, www.totalnegotiation.com. It's long, but it gets us there. We have a LinkedIn page. So again, just Total Negotiation Group, or just look at me directly on LinkedIn. So Mark Grice, and you'll find me on LinkedIn, Total Negotiation Group. Very open. Anybody wants to get in touch, please do and connect.
Amazing, Mark. Well, we will put links to all of those in the show notes. And as I say, thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed this, and all the best for the rest of your week.
Thanks very much, Nick. Love to speak with you. Bye.
Cheers, Mark.
Today's episode is brought to you by Create Engage, the specialist digital marketing agency for the disruptive management consultancy. Now, for long-time listeners, you will probably already know who we are. You may have even heard one of our ads on a previous episode of this podcast. But for those of you who don't, here is a short introduction. At Create Engage, we help you create an effective marketing strategy for your consultancy, a strategy that will resonate with your target clients. And then we support you by delivering the campaigns you need to turn that strategy into a reality, helping you to build your brand, raise your profile with your prospective clients, and ultimately generate return on investment from your marketing activity. Now, I could tell you about many of the great clients that we work with and the results we've delivered for them. But instead, I'm going to do something much more powerful and something that I would recommend you do for your own marketing. I'm going to let our clients do the talking for us. If you are currently thinking about marketing for your consultancy, you're going to want to listen to this.
Create Engage started the process for us. They managed it end to end. They came up with some really creative ideas, and we were really happy with the work that they did, which meant that we could just focus on running the business. Not only did we start conversations with clients that we hadn't spoken to before, but also there was tangible return on investment by some work that we were given.
They've helped right from the initial shaping of the idea through to helping us work out what our end goal was. They've supported us with the visual identity and our positioning of the brand.
We've had an immediate expansion of our network and have initiated a raft of new conversations with owners, CEOs in target client organisations, and has led to us winning new projects already.
One of the greatest compliments, I guess, is that one of our competitors even said that they really like what we're doing with marketing. They wish they could be doing something as good.
So from our perspective, we couldn't recommend Create Engage any more than this.
I would certainly recommend Create Engage if you're a consulting firm. They really understand consultancies and the sort of challenges we face. And I don't think you're going to get much better marketing anywhere else.
So I wouldn't hesitate to recommend Create Engage. They did a really good job for us.
So if you're looking for an agency that can help you achieve the results that our clients just described, then head to our website, createengage.co.uk, where you can find out more about how we support consulting firms like you. You can download our latest ebook, and you can get in touch to talk about how we can help you take your consultancy to the next level through digital marketing.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Climbing Consulting. If you have any guest recommendations, comments, ideas, thoughts on how I can make this show better for you, just drop me an email. It's nick@createengage.co.uk. And I really look forward to hearing from you.